Hey everybody, welcome back to Bald Movies. We've got a really cool one this week. Apollo 13. Did you know that we are days away from the 25th anniversary of this movie coming out, Jim?
No, I had no idea. That's definitely not why we planned to do this movie right when we did.
Damn it, you should let me know in advance if you're not going to go into the shtick. But I was
I
shocked.
I leaned into it, just, you know, with a wink.
I was shocked when we discovered this fact, because I'm like, I don't think this movie feels this old. This is the year that I graduated high school. I was 18 years old when this movie came out. I always feel like I was, you know, 25 or so. So I was blown away, and thus, because it's been, I don't know, a minute since I've seen Apollo 13. I was amazed at how young everyone looks.
Yeah.
You know, we just saw Ed Harris, old man Ed Harris, the Man in Black and Westworld, looking dusty.
Yeah, I can't even imagine desiccated. What he looked like in The Right Stuff.
Yeah, he's got golden blonde hair. He's a Jamie Lannister.
Yeah,
still balding. I actually have his exact same balding pattern. I can't wait. I'm going to twin separated mohawk, receding hairline.
Nice. You need to get a nice big cowboy hat.
I need his baby blues, because yeah. I think that's the reason the man's been able to hold it down as a sex symbol all these years.
Yeah.
But and he's charismatic.
That helps.
Qualities I don't have. But this was a lot of fun, and we did this specifically because it is the 25th anniversary of the movie coming out. This movie, of course, was directed by Ron Howard, with a screenplay by William Broyles and Al Reinert. It was based on the book Lost Moon, which was written by Jim Lovell, the commander of Apollo 13, co-written by journalist Jeffrey Kluger. It stars, of course, Tom Hanks as Jim Lovell, the commander, as we said, Kevin Bacon as Jack Swigert, who is going to be the commander of the, I guess, command module, and they're the chief pilot. Bill Paxton as Fred Hayes, who is the, what do you call that, the second banana on the lunar lander?
support role. I don't know.
Yeah, the guy that helps Jim Lovell into his spacesuit. No, damning the man with very faint praise. Of course, Bill, I feel like I don't need to explain who Tom Hanks is, because even like Generation Z knows who the fuck Tom Hanks is. Kevin Bacon is a meme. But like Bill Paxton, if you don't know, is a man's a legend.
Yeah.
Aliens, Weird Science, The Terminator, Rise of Tomorrow, Nightcrawler, Twister, True Lies. Just amazing career.
And just some of the best lines, period, in Hollywood. Like, I don't know how Bill Paxton got all these great lines, but there's many memorable, like Game Over, Man, Game Over, that one.
Yeah. He's got bugs, man.
he's got an amazing one in this where he says, I could eat the ass out of a dead rhinoceros.
Yeah.
Like, where does he get them?
Yeah, it's a reprise of his eating a greasy pork sandwich out of an ashtray.
Weird Science. Yep.
Ed Harris, who, as we just mentioned, is gotten notable work of late as the Man in Black in Westworld, but also started off, but early career work in The Right Stuff, which is the first movie I saw him in, The Abyss, Glengarry Glenn Ross, Nixon, The Truman Show, A History of Violence, and he plays NASA mission control director Gene Kranz with some style. Gary Sinise, another guy who hasn't gotten a lot of work of late, but he was kind of like my early cinema hero. I saw him first in Of Mice and Men in high school as an assigned, you know, we read the book and then we saw the movie. Forrest Gump, Mission to Mars, The Green Mile. He plays Ken Mattingly, which is the, I guess, replacement Jack Swigert position. They were afraid he was going to come down with measles. Mm-hmm. And then Kathleen Quinlan, who I've not really seen a lot from, but she had prominent roles in American Graffiti and The Doors as Jim Lovell's wife, Marilyn, who I, you know, these are often thankless roles. You know, I think of like Sissy Spacek in JFK, and it's just this hectoring woman that's always holding the heroic man down. And I thought she was like really fucking cool, the way she dealt with the journalist, the way she dealt with the trauma that the children were undergoing, the way she was like supportive of her husband, who has a very dangerous but important job. I don't know. I thought it was a pretty nice portrayal of a pretty positive relationship.
Yeah, that conflict between, you know, excitement and worry, she portrayed that really well.
Yeah, yeah. It felt very real and grounded and sympathetic rather than just like, oh, Jesus, can someone get some duct tape here. So that's the principles. What do you think of this movie, Jim?
It's one of my favorite movies. I've actually seen this movie countless times. I sat down one day when I was sick. I stayed home from school and I watched this movie back to back like six times in a row, maybe. I laid in bed all day just watching this movie.
You Groundhog Day'd it.
I really did. I pulled a marathon. And you know, it's a super engaging film. It's like everything I love. It's like they distilled MacGyver through like the vacuum of space.
Man, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
You know, like when they dump out all that stuff on the table and they're like, we got to make this fit in this and we got to use just what's on the table here. I'm like, that is so fucking cool. I would love to be in that room.
We got
to
do it in a matter of hours or three men die.
Right. The stakes are super high. It's just an amazing film. And the fact that it's based on a real life event, and I don't know how much embellishment there is here, but I'm pretty sure from everything I've read in my research that this is roughly what happened. You know, there were multiple burns along the way. They had to, you know, they had all these problems with water and power and CO2, all that stuff. They had to overcome it. It's one of the finest hours, I think, as they mentioned in the movie, that the NASA's ever had.
Yeah, and I did some research into, like, because I was wondering that too, the embellishments. And I guess there's a couple sequences that were slightly reordered to make it more clear, or the stakes more clear. And there was also a lot of, this was a 8 or 9 day mission, and there's a couple of jumps where we jump a day or two at a time because there's probably nothing happening. Then, you know, right. It's still a dire situation, guys freezing in space, but like, and then they also reordered some dialogue, like that one scene where Tom Hanks breaks up Kevin Bacon and Bill Paxton and says, you know, gentlemen, what is your intention? You know, mine is to go home. I guess that was in, it has a real line from him, but the context of it is Swigert and Fred and Hayes were like trying to take pictures out of the moon and like, you know, just like geeking out like this is their first moon experience, which it was. And he's kind of like, come on, you know, I understand this is amazing, but if you don't get home, this film won't get developed. What is your intention, gentlemen?
Yeah.
So it was something that kind of like, you know, serves as the transition from second to third arc drama. And Hollywood it a bit. But no, yeah, I mean, this like all this shit that went wrong went actually wrong. And it is it's almost... You know, if this movie, you didn't think, if it wasn't based on a real life event, you'd think it's like Gravity, right? Well, it's just one goddamn thing after another, one impossible challenge after another. But it was real and it actually happened. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it's like, there's been some events like this in my time. Like I remember when, there was this little girl that got stuck in a well down in Texas. Like a 3-year-old fell down a well, and like they did like, oh, you know, they had to pump oxygen down to her and a microphone to keep her company. And she was down there for like, I don't know how many days and nights, and they had to dig this parallel structure, and the world gets captivated by it. The Chilean miners, those children that were trapped underground in that cave. Where was that? The Philippines, Malaysia, right. Malaysia. It's like such a cool, captivating thing. Like, you know, the world kind of like you got the slow moving disaster and heroism and ingenuity. And this happened in space.
Yeah. The most hostile environment.
And it's like it's so futuristic, too. Like we had a space crisis that we had to rescue people from.
The level, the bar here is so fucking high, right? Like,
yeah,
it's OK. It's one thing to be stuck underground in a cave, but at least there is oxygen around and the people, you know, can survive if, you know, there's a hole in their ship or like it's a race against time, but it's somehow easier because it's not a million miles away or however far away they are.
Like I was watching this with Jack and, you know, we were remarking on, like, when the astronauts, like, once they get in the atmosphere and they haven't landed or anything yet, like, immediately the tension bleeds because there's a many things that could go wrong. Parachutes could still fail. That capsule could sink. A helicopter could crash. But holy shit, you're now on a rock that is no longer inimicable to your human life. Like, you've got, you can get big lungs of air anywhere you got. What go? You can find water. You can do, it's just like, even though their danger is still there, it's not space, you know? Yeah. And I just... You know, like, Ron Howard has this reputation for being, like, this kind of, like, nuts and bolts, meat and potatoes, workman-like director. But as we said, like, last week with Coogler's really effective Fruitvale Station, sometimes that's what you want. You don't, like, I don't know that you need really splashy cinematography. Not that there's not any, like, really inventive shots and effects works here. But, like, it just, the story is good enough. You just need to stand back at a remove and tell it.
Yeah.
And it really shows that you really feel like you're in the capsule. And I think a lot of them insisting on using real props and real sets and not as much green screen and actual zero G stuff really makes you feel like it's in there.
Yeah. So can we talk about that? Because
do you want to do a thing where we talk about the movie just in case people don't know which movie we're talking about, like
what Apollo 13 is?
Okay, yeah, like, yeah. You know, we found that recently. Do we have like 15-16 year old fans? Like, you might know what the fuck is Apollo 13. So Apollo 13 is about this. It was going to be the third lunar mission actually landed on the moon. There were several like warm-up dry runs where, for example, Jim Lovell is commander of Apollo 8, where they just went to the moon and orbited it and came back, you know?
Yeah.
But this is going to be the third time we actually set foot on the moon. And like a day or two into the mission, an oxygen tank blew up and threw everything into chaos. No longer were these men going to land in the moon. It was an open question of whether we could get them back.
And it looked like the answer was no.
And it looked like there's many, many, many things stand, you know, that could have gone wrong that led to them not. And this is a 2.5 hour that feels like it's about 90 minutes long movie that explores every facet of that and the human drama that went into it. And it's really fascinating and inspirational, which is why, you know, sometimes it's hard to find things in the moment to be proud of as an American. But every once in a while, we do some cool stuff. And really, like, you know, inspire the entire world, just like the Malaysian kids did, and the just like the Chilean guys did to mine. Sometimes we can fuck up and be so vulnerable that the world's like, oh shit, let's feel sorry for these Americans and pray for their safe return. And we fucking did it right here at Apollo 13. Happy 4th of July, everybody. So that's the pitch. That's the pitch if you're one of our 15-year-old fans and has no idea who Tom Hanks is or Kevin Bacon and why you should care about some space mission 50 years ago. It's a real feel-good story.
Yeah, and I think it's super cool because the way this film was made, because you've got a film about the Space Administration on one of its, you know, most doomed but also most heroic missions. And they are using, I don't know what they're called, the planes. I know what the plane is called. It's KC-135, which
vomit
is the plane
comet.
That goes, what's that?
The Vomit Comet.
Okay, yeah, colloquially, sure. Yeah, it's the plane that goes into the upper atmosphere and will do these maneuvers that give you the feeling of give you an experience of zero G.
Yeah, it just goes in multiple like parabolic arcs. So like on the top of the arc, you're experiencing zero G, and then when you get to the bottom of the arc, you're experiencing like 3 or 4 G as it's pulling up. But like you get that, what is it, like 15 to 30 seconds of weightlessness?
Yeah, it's about 25 seconds. And so when you're seeing shots of Tom Hanks and Kevin Bacon and Bill Paxton floating around this capsule and this limb, that's really zero G filming. They filmed this, those key scenes in 25 second increments on board an airplane that was doing these parabolic zero G maneuvers. It's actually kind of mind blowing that this film is as good as it is, given that they had to shoot it in those small chunks. And you can tell, like, the editing is fast and furious in those scenes. You know, they're cutting back and forth and it's clearly chopped and screwed to look better than it would in raw film. But man, they do a great job, and it really adds to the effect. Like, I never stopped and thought about how they got those effects when I was younger. When I was watching it this time, I was like, how the fuck did they get them spinning around through this narrow passageway? Were they on wires and some intricate system?
Or the thing that's like super hard even for CGI now is like the time where like Kevin Bacon was squeezing the orange juice and it like he's splashing against his arm and forming into a ball that he then sucked in. Like, that's very hard to do convincingly with special effects.
Yeah, convincingly.
But if you rent the Vomit Comet and you can get that taken for 20 seconds, then you're gold.
It's kind of amazing. Yeah, I'm shocked that this film ever actually got made.
You know, it's got a budget of $52 million. I got to think that NASA probably kicked in 10 for free, because
it would be good
there's
advertising.
No way that they were able to do the hundreds of probably flights it would take to get all those scenes. Maybe just Ron Howard's that fucking efficient. Like, he only needed 10 to 15 flights. Yeah. But I'm thinking like that Kevin Bacon thing where he's spraying orange juice all over himself and Bill Paxton. That's every time you have to reset that every fucking time, right? Because the orange juice is going just fucking everywhere.
Right. You need like some kind of vacuum to get that stuff. Or I guess, no, you wait until you get to the 3-4G maneuver and then you mop it up.
Yeah.
But it's amazing. It's amazing.
And I want to say that like you were talking about the technical limitations about how you have to like shoot those in small increments and confine tight spaces. But like, I also think that's one of the things that makes you feel like you're in the capsule.
Absolutely.
If you go, like, me and Jack just went this winter, right before everything fucked up, you know, it was in January or February, we went to the Apollo mission exhibit at the Cincinnati Museum of Natural History. It's a traveling exhibit, and it was like the last couple weeks to see it. And every time I see one of those capsules, we saw the actual command module from Apollo 11. Every time I see one of those, I think, Jesus Christ, this is such a tiny area.
Yeah, for two people to be in, yeah.
And it feels like a really cramped. Like they say, it's like three phone booths worth of like a spare space. And it feels like that. And the camera's in there, too. And I just feel like that really felt like you were almost watching documentary footage. And they do a lot of adding like grain and effects and stuff to make it feel like it's like a contemporary thing. But like, I just think those limitations make the movie what it is. Because if you double the budget and do it all CG... or with harnesses and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
The Expanse does a pretty good job, but you can tell people faking. Yeah.
Absolutely. And there's so much of it too. Like they talk about how, we shot key scenes in that airplane. And I'm thinking, when you're talking key scenes in this movie, you're talking like 50% of the movie was shot in that, in those capsules. Like,
yeah.
It's amazing to me that the amount of effort that had to have gone into that.
Yeah. Recreating that stuff. And the other thing is, I guess not NASA offered the mission control, but how Ron Howard wanted, I almost said Howard Johnson. Hojo said, no,
we could do it in our conference room. God damn it.
Yeah. There's going to be orange sorbet. it's going to have a blue and orange. No, I think that he made the decision to recreate it. And I guess some of the NASA guys that they got on for advisor, like when they were ending their day on the set, they would like instinctively go for an elevator shaft from where they know it was a mission control. And I was like, oh, shit, that's right. We're on the ground floor. This isn't really mission control, because I guess the real mission control is like up three flights or something. So I can't believe this got made for $50 million. Of course, it was. You're going to have to start doing economic adjustments for this, man, because 25 years ago, like that $50 million wasn't $50 million exactly. But
I mean, but Tom Hanks was making 20 of that. So like,
I wonder, because I guess one of the reasons they went after John Travolta and who's the
Nicolas Cage.
No, who's the Waterworld guy? Dancing with Buffaloes.
Kevin Costner.
They went after him first, those two guys first. And I guess Tom Hanks won because he is genuinely passionate about three subjects. Typewriters, World War II, and the fucking space program. He has spent countless millions of his own dollars on, well, I don't know about the typewriter stuff, but probably. Countless millions on his own stuff. Like, have you actually seen From the Earth to the Moon, the HBO series? Oh, I've got the box set, man. Do you want to borrow it sometime?
I should, because
it's essentially 14 hours of this.
That sounds awesome.
All Yeah, from like from, you know, the Apollo 1 on. And well, that's another one. Like, I forgot how what a bummer minor chord note this movie begins on. It starts with the Apollo 1 fire. The formative disaster of NASA, where we burnt up.
You don't want your first mission to go up in flames, literally.
Literally, yeah, yeah.
And kill some famed astronauts. Like, Gus Grissom, what was he, like, first American in space or something like that?
I think he was either the first in space or the first to complete an orbit. I can't remember which one. But yeah, he's like, he was our Yuri Gagarin, and we burnt that man on a launch pad with a bunch of shoddy testing, engineering, rushed compromises to get this like 10-year plan done. And one of the men that turned this around was Gene Kranz. Like, he gave this famous like speech in front of NASA where he said, you know, mission control is going to be defined by our toughness and our competency, and part of our toughness is we're going to stand up when, you know, people are trying to rush us and cut corners. And you know,
and Gene Kranz is the guy played by Ed Harris in this film.
Yes, the guy wearing the white mission vest.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I am completely in the tank for this film. I thought it was amazing when I first saw it. I've seen it probably 10 times. It was a really fun experience watching it with my 13-year-old. Because I know he's super into space and he's familiar with this story. But he just like was, it's rare to watch something this long with him without him trying to fidget with his phone and stuff. And he was just like sucked in from like literally minute one. 'Cause they started with the Apollo fire, which is something I think he wrote a report on last year.
Huh.
And the other thing is, you know, how we were talking about, you know, last week, with Oscar, the Fruitvale Station. How we were like, even knowing that we knew that this movie ended in his death, we were rooting for him.
Yeah.
This movie also gets me like nervous for Tom Hanks and Jim Lovell and everybody, even though I know they're going to be fine.
How could it like, not, though?
Because there's like many questions, many points in this film I kept on questioning, like what it would be like. What would it be like to know that you were going to go to moon sometime next year and now it's been moved up 6 months because of something? What would it feel like to be at a hotel room and you are just fucking around and suddenly get a phone call? Oh, the person you're understudied for is going to be scrubbed. You're going to the moon in 4 days or whatever it was. What it must be like to be the guy who's not sick at all and is get scrubbed from a moon mission.
Yeah.
And
I
like,
mean,
you know,
the irony of it, right? That he's stuck, Mattingly stuck on the ground, and Hayes is up there, you know, on death's door with 104 degree fever, all that stuff.
Yeah. Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
I've seen this movie a bunch of times. I've always taken it like as a joke what Hayes said about Swigert giving him an STD from the tube, but like, was that legit?
I think it's a joke,
but it could, like, I think that checks out. Like, I think you probably could spread a sexually transmitted disease if you shared penis tubes.
Yeah,
because that's essentially how it spreads, right? You get your P tubes and your V tubes, and they start inserting them and putting them in different combinations, and the bugs just hit your ride.
It's true.
So I don't know. I don't know if you can get from a toilet seat, like, you know, but from a penis tube, yeah. Maybe.
There's a lot of like you talked about, you know, some of the like the, I guess, inauspicious intro to this movie with the fire of Apollo 1, and that continues for a good like 40 minutes or something in this movie. I don't know when is the point, like what's the time code when they finally get on this mission, but it takes a while.
Oh, yeah.
And the entire time they're hitting you with thing after thing, like, lucky number 13 mission, huh?
Mm-hmm.
The wife drops her ring down the drain. Like, there's so many little things that they're just saying, this is a doomed mission. And I get it. Like, that's the point. It just, at some point, like, I started noticing, I'm like, oh boy, they're really laying it on thick here.
Yeah. And then there's also contrasting just like the consummate professionalism of the astronaut corps and everyone that works there. Like, that they just, you know, practice all these scenarios, and that's why these people can, you know, if at all possible, put this kind of stuff together, because you've got the best of the best. They've trained for everything. They don't panic. They are solution oriented. And it's really neat to see that. And that's what they do in the first 40 minutes of the movie. They show you all this inauspicious signs and also like how competent. I also thought it was interesting, like, though, like that one's the, I wonder what, how I'm supposed to feel about the scene where, Akin, is that, what is it, Mattingly? Yeah, Ken Mattingly steals simulation time from Jack Swigert because he's the prime team and he's the other, Swigert's the subprime team because, like, oh, you know, we didn't get this, you know, mission 75A subroutine just right. Let's practice a couple more times. They bump him, and I'm like, that might have bit you in the ass because you've got a guy who's slightly less qualified.
Yeah, they call him rookie a couple times. I guess it's just because he's the first time he's been in space.
Right.
But also, there's, you know, a duality there. It's like, okay, yeah, he's stealing time from the guy who eventually becomes the pilot of this mission. But also, there's a story that Tom Hanks tells on the news in an interview previously about this this algae, right, that guided him home. He just got fucking lucky that his cockpit blacked out. And he was able to see that algae. His algae in this mission is that Ken Mattingly got bumped from the mission, even though he wasn't sick, right? It's like, it's this bit of luck that put him in the position to bring them home safely, because Ken Mattingly, as portrayed by the film, I'm not sure if this is true or if there were a bunch of engineers that figured this, you know, amperage problem out. Mm-hmm. But Ken Mattingly in the movie is the guy who cracked the solution to getting their computers back online to bring them home safely. Right. If he was on the ship, he wouldn't have had access to be able to do that stuff.
Right. And, you know, like, the reason he's able to help them is his utter mastery of the systems and the ships.
Yeah.
And
so there is, like, a little bit of, you know, misfortune and fortune tied together there.
Right. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
Executive producers get to exercise their voting fingers again this week with another prestige movie poll. This week's nominees are Mystic River, The Last Samurai, and Secondhand Lions. Take your pick and seal our fate.
This Monday on the Premium feed, we open up the books and deliver a State of the Empire podcast, talking about the current condition of Bald Move and our plans for this year.
This Friday, it's Lunch 420, which, given last weekend, seems like a tragic missed opportunity. Ah, well. Lunch will be served piping hot at 1 p.m. Eastern. Come join live or warm up some leftovers when lunch is released in podcast form later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds. Man, where do you want to go from here?
Can we talk about some of the actors in this? Because, like, everybody who's everybody is in this movie. Like, you can stick with the top four and say, okay, those are some of the biggest actors of that generation. I don't know how, but, like, Ed Harris has had, like, stealthily one of the best careers. Like, he's high profile, but I never think of him as being, like, the world's biggest movie star. And yet, when I think of all the movies I love, Ed Harris pops up in a unreasonable amount of those.
He's sneaky A-list.
He absolutely is, as much as Tom Hanks is. But yeah, you got those two guys.
It's like Gary Oldman's another one, sneaky A-list, man. Right. Like, you're like, you don't think of them as being, but then, like, oh Jesus, look at all the stuff they're in.
Absolutely. And certainly people, you know, of my generation are very much familiar with Ed Harris's work. And then you've got a cast of the second tier people here that is just full it's full of Howards, because Ron Howard just decided, I'm going to cast everybody in my family in this movie.
Did you know that
the mom of Jim Lovell is actually Ron Howard's mother?
I remember thinking that, like, this is either Jim Lovell's actual mother or, that might be Marilyn Lovell. Because the way, like, I just thought, like, there's a little something that's not professional but winsome about it, like authentic. But no, it's actually Howard's mom.
It is, yeah. And it turns out she's an actress. Like, Like they pulled her out of, you know, a nursing home in real life and stuck her in there. It's just like she was playing a part. And Clint Howard, obviously, everybody's familiar with him. He's he's a top tier, in my opinion, character actor. He's I don't know his role, the name of his position in this film, but he's the guy with the headset. I don't know how to describe him. That describes
everybody. Everybody's got like a little. It reminds me of like, you know, we're talking about, this is going to be a weird comparison, but that movie, that King Kong Skull Island movie. Remember we talked about how like it's kind of remarkable that you had like 12 dudes in this film, and every one of them got like three or four really superable definable traits and like characteristics and vocal patterns or like backstory. It is very efficient. Like I felt like every goddamn person in Mission Control, through their casting, costuming, way of speaking, just the like the little characterization they give, just like when they're checking, like how they all have a different way of saying go for whatever. Like you get to know, there's like 20 different dudes that I don't know their individual names and stuff, but like the flight doctor, the who's the guy that looks like a Meatballs character, or a Revenge of the Geeks character?
I mean, it's probably Clint Howard.
Oh yes, yes. There's just like tons of these things, and they're so efficiently like sketched in, that it really it's a delight, and it's really neat to see these guys' performances and like the way they mutter under the breath about the shit that Gene Kranz is saying, and because Gene Kranz like seems like such a fucking cool customer, and it's not that he never rants and raves, because every once in a while he does, but like it's just. Every time him likes to slow down, calm down one at a time, you know, think through the problem, you know, failure's not an option. I just really liked what Ed Harris did with the role. And apparently it's, you know, that's what he was all about. He's not a big fan of the direction of human spaceflight for the last 20 years.
I'm not either.
Or lack thereof.
Very much lack thereof.
Yeah, like he's like really bemoans that like when faced with real, you know, challenges like the Columbia disaster, NASA shrinks away rather than hold itself accountable, double down on safety and training and planning. And instead it's just like, well, shit, we just can't do this anymore. Look, we're killing too many people. Right. We better not send people up there. It's fucking too dangerous. And he's just like, you know, I think this is like it's fair to have the discussion about like, how much should you spend on space flight when there's so many problems here on Earth? But also, I do respect the eye on the long game, which is we can't stay on this rock forever.
Yeah.
Like it's you know, whether it's 100 years or 1,000 years or 100,000 years from now, something's going to happen that where if we keep our eggs all in this one basket, we're going to be fucked.
And it's clear that we're outgrowing it too.
There needs to be, you know, we need more resources. We need reduce, recycle, reuse, all that stuff too. But yeah, we also need more resources to keep growing as a civilization, a population. And I think we can do both, you know. I think we can solve a lot of the problems here on the ground and, you know, still inspire people with manned space flights and colonization efforts and whatnot.
Yeah, and that's one of the other reasons why this is such a perfect movie to do right now. You know, it's not only the 25th anniversary of Apollo 13 as a film, but also this is the anniversary or, you know, our reemergence of putting people into space as a country. And I think that's super exciting. I think it's there's a potential double-edged sword here with privatized spaceflight, I think.
Yes.
I think it's good in some ways. I think the idea that like it's too risky to go to space and that if we kill people in the process, that's going to be a huge problem for an administration like NASA. Mm-hmm. Whereas, for better or worse, corporations, I think, look at that as the cost of doing business. If it's going to get us out into space and they have to pay a few settlements over lawsuits of dead astronauts, they're probably going to go for it as long as it makes economic sense. And there's a lot of resources in space and a lot of money in those contracts. Mm-hmm. So
I do wonder though that the first time that SpaceX kills like three astronauts, like the congressional hearings after that are going to be very interesting to see whether it's like, ah, oh, no, we got to shut all this shit down, or we're going to make so much regulation it's no longer practical.
But I've seen it. It's like look at what fucking Purdue Pharma up to with the opioids, right?
Right.
And they get lawsuits and they're just like, yeah, cost of doing
congressional
business.
Yeah, they get whipped. Or Zuckerberg with social media. Like, yeah, he gets...
Settlements are built into the price. Like, it sucks. Like, that's a terrible way to be, but it's the way we are. And so that might be actually a boon to getting people out into space.
Yeah. I want to talk about some specific things I thought were really cool. There's this early scene where Jim Lovell is, you know, in the backyard after I had this big party for Apollo 11. And he's putting his like thumb over the moon and kind of like, you know, as like a little rangefinder kind of thing. And there's a scene, a callback, like as we shift from the second to third act where he's leaving the moon, not going to see it again. And he does the same thing with the Earth. And I thought that was like a really like, God, to be so close again.
Yeah.
And this was his final space flight, too. Like, to be so close to being immortalized as one of the very few men vanishing a small amount of humanity that's actually walked on the moon. Man. But on the other hand, like, as far as the public imagination is concerned, Apollo 11 and Apollo 13 are the only missions that mattered. So, like, even though some dope shit happened on later lunar missions, did you know that one of the astronauts played around the golf on the moon? Fuck yeah, he did. Brought his 9-iron and a few golf balls and took a couple, I'm sure, 2,000-meter drives out there
say,
on the lunar mares. Like,
and the holes up there are pretty easy to hit.
Got on film. Look it up. There's some really cool stuff happened, but, like, you know, nobody gives a shit because America itself. Like, I thought that was an insane statement that the networks, all four of the networks at the time, wasn't going to cover humans going to the moon just a third time. Mm-hmm. Third human, the humans went to the moon because they made it seem so boring. And I'm like, how was that ever boring? Like, maybe Apollo 12 just did a really rotten in-flight camera thing. I don't know, but like these dudes were having fun playing
it's like
popular
the Star
music.
Wars holiday special up there on 12.
Yeah, it was just lumpy watching Wookiee porn, and you know, there's no translations of the roaring and growling. I don't know. I often wonder, like, was that actually true? That like the Americans just didn't care about space travel that quickly, like a year and a half into this process, and we land on the moon, it was amazing, and I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either, but it seems plausible.
It's a shame. Yeah. It's a shame,
and
this stuff.
I love the moment that it leads to with the wife when they try and put the transmitter on her lawn.
Right.
And she's like, well, they didn't care when we were going to land on the moon, and now it's extra fucking boring because we're not landing on the moon. They can fuck off. Like, that was so good.
And, you know, again, like, fuck the media both ways, because they didn't give a shit about, like, the successful fun mission to the moon. And then they also wanted to, like, trample on this family and interfere with their, you know, because it's like the public has a right to know how much shit Jim Lovell's wife is losing. Mm-hmm. What does his kid think? What does his daughters think? Are they crying? Let's see their red puffy eyes. The public has a right to man, fuck all of that. That's not news. That's not journalism. That's, you know what? That's a journalistic equivalent of fucking ripping and rolling corner boys in Baltimore. Like, that's the easy fucking work you guys are doing to put off the really hard work of journalism.
Yeah.
So suck a journalistic dick and then put it down and go do some real journalism. Anyway, we're talking about Apollo 13, I think. I want to talk about, like, just I thought they really sold those moments, and they had like an elaborate like fantasy sequence of Jim Lovell imagining him being on the moon. I thought that stuff was really cool. I was also surprised at how much really funny humor, like the Jim Lovell constantly worrying about him, or like after he's had this like fights with the crew, and he's like, "Are we on Vox?" Because of the previous time where he was getting pissy with Mission Control, not knowing that he was on open mic, and like there's a little bit of that like bosom buddies, bachelor party Tom Hanks, you know, that comic energy coming through.
Yep.
The steely-eyed missile man quote comes from this movie that later like becomes part of The Martian. I thought,
yeah,
that was really fucking cool because it wasn't just like a really neat quote and a really awesome line, but it analogizes the situation with, you know, Matt Damon, whatever his character is, on the Mars with the Apollo 13 rescue mission. Yeah. Like, you're a steely eyed missile man. I thought that was really fucking cool. And it's been since I've seen The Martian and read The Martian since I've seen this movie. So I didn't make that connection.
Well, I think it's a real life quote, but I can't remember who said it. Yeah, I know I looked it up for the Martian podcast, but I don't remember.
Yeah, no. I just thought it was that made me smile. I really liked Jim Lovell's mom, you know, when she asked the kids whether they're scared or not. And she's like, you should relax, because if they could invent a washing machine that could fly, my Jimmy could land it. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, eating the ass out of a dead rhinoceros is fantastic. That's a great line and excellently delivered by Bill Paxton, R.I.P.
I also like the Grumman engine, like limb motor guy, constantly like, well, this thing's designed to get you off the moon. It's not designed to get you like just constantly. And then the second it works, he's like, how about that? Like, you know, again, that's a character. Yeah. How about that limb? I love it. I love that guy.
Okay, I'm glad you said the word limb. Can you explain to me? Okay, so Swaggart is on this mission as a pilot, right? And he is kind of, it seems like he's in control of the command module.
Yeah.
But there's a separate module here that's the limb, which is what they're actually going to use to go down onto the moon. Why does he never pilot that? Is he not trained on that?
Because
Jim Lovell always pilots that, and even when they're like doing the burn, the course correction burn,
I think that's it.
Jim Lovell and Hayes.
You nailed it. Like, Swaggart is the pilot of the command module. Lovell is the pilot and commander of the lunar descent module and lunar landing module, and they're completely different systems.
I think they have lots of different stuff
and the way they would handle with the, you know, the and I also think that's, there's some interesting things where it's like, clearly they didn't do simulations of like doing burns with all this shit attached, you know, like that was never in part of the plan. So there's a lot of realistic like, oh Christ, this is like trying to, you know, turn three boats in a row, or I can't remember the term or phrase, but
yeah, trying to hit like this piece of paper, you know, scale. And like,
there's also this thing where like their controls are reversed because they were literally thrusting this thing in reverse from what it's expected, because it wasn't designed to use the lunar landing module as a thruster. So like, they had to remember not just all the other shit going in, but oh, when you push up, that's going to be down, down's going to be up, left's going to be right, right. It's like, God damn. And the terror of like, well, you got to make this 30-second burn and you got to keep this attitude in the right direction, because you got to hit that piece of paper side on, and if you don't, you're going to die. You're either going to die screaming in a fire, or you're going to die slow, asphyxiated and freezing to death in outer space.
Yeah,
shit,
that's intense.
Oh man. But I don't know, the Apollo story missions are full of shit like that. Like, you've heard, I just found out about this like 5 years ago, but like when Neil Armstrong was landing Apollo 11, like the autolander was going to set them down on a field of rubble, like big boulders and stuff. And he was concerned that the limb would tip over, which would eventually kill them all. So he took manual control and skirted past that, landed the thing with like 5 seconds of fuel remaining. And they were giving him the fuel countdown in his ear, like, you know, you got 10 seconds, eight, and he just lands it. And you listen to the recording of him doing that, you would never know he's scared, but like the medical recorder showed that his heart rate was like 180 BPMs when he's like trying to fucking land this thing. They're all cool fucking customers, like real life Brad Pitt from Ad Astra. Well, I guess they actually, their hearts raced. They just kept it out of their official communications.
So we talked about Ron Howard being a pretty utilitarian director most of the time, and I think that's true here. You know, other than the zero G shooting that they did, but there's some tricks he uses that I think are super effective, like cutting to the news coverage of this event, because they're able to tell you as an audience member exactly what the risks are and exactly what the problems are. Then you're able to go to inside NASA to see what the solutions are. And I think that was a really nice piece of directing.
Yeah, it's like a great way to do exposition, yeah. Right? Like, this is the shit that like a viewing audience would need to understand, because obviously Walter Cronkite thought it was something the viewing audience need to understand.
Yeah.
And it sets it up so you don't have to have the scene of the NASA guys like, well, it's, you know, I mean, there's one of those where Ed Harris drew the Earth and the Moon on the chalkboard and said, here's the problem. But like, there's only so many things like that you can do before it's like, why are the NASA guys reviewing this? They fucking know. Yeah. Like, so like being able to do that with the, I guess a lot of times contemporary news reports, although I did hear that Ron Howard had Walter Cronkite, which is still alive at the time, do a couple of custom voiceovers to do like, to do a little of that exposition, a little bit more of it.
Nice.
It's at least according to the trivia article I read. So, I agree. It's a great way to do that. What about the medical mutiny? I thought that the flight doctors got a little bit too much shit in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, they were the whipping boys.
They know what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. But also just to like, it's not horse shit to scrub an astronaut who got exposed to the measles and has never been exposed to the measles before.
Yeah.
Like everything they said about that being a bad idea, it sucks that like the Hayes ended up being the one that got sick. But like, you know, they're like, this is flight doctor. This is, you know, flight doctor bullshit or flight surgeon bullshit. And yeah, they also cast this like really dopey actor who the only other thing I've ever seen him do is play like a profoundly Asperger's inflicted lawyer on Boston Legal. You know, like they cast as Poindexter to play this position in NASA that's kind of reviled. But I'm like, I don't know. Should he just shut the fuck up about a potentially dangerous viral situation?
No.
Happening 220,000 miles from Earth. Like, seems like that's part of being tough and competent. But
yeah, absolutely.
You need a villain, I guess, for the astronauts to rage against.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Gravity made space the villain. We couldn't do that here.
Yeah. But I do like how they just like, you know, find it's like, you know what? We're not doing well up here. We're not sleeping. Our heart rates are erratic. Fuck you. Just rip it off.
Yeah.
Tired of hearing about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're either going to die or they're not, right? It's not like knowing their heart rate is going to change the scenario here.
Right. I also enjoyed, speaking of comedy, the portrayal of Jim Lovell's mother being babysat by these two, you know, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin.
Uh-huh.
And she clearly doesn't know who either of them are. They're like, hey, I'm Neil, this is Buzz, and we're going to keep you company while you're watching, you know, we're trying to distract you from watching your son roast to death. And she's like, oh, are you boys in the space program too? And they kind of look at each other like,
yeah,
these are at the time probably the two most famous Americans. Outside of like what Muhammad Ali and maybe President Nixon, and she has no idea. It's so great. Did you know that Jim Lovell played the ship's captain from the recovery ship, the USS Iwo Jima?
Like the actual Jim Lovell?
Yeah, the actual Jim Lovell played the ship's captain as he shakes Tom Hanks' hand and like was clapping him on the shoulder, getting him out of it. That's actually Jim Lovell.
No, I didn't. That's cool.
And Ron Howard said he was going to make him an admiral on that ship. And Jim Lovell said, well, I retired as a captain and I still got my uniform. And that's what he wore on that day.
Nice.
didn't want the promotion admiral.
Yeah.
That's desk jockey shit, man.
Yeah,
he wants to be in the seat.
You know, look, NASA is not part of the military, right? They're not part of the military structure. But
I mean, I think Space Force made it explicit. Like, there's always like close cooperation between the military, NASA, and the space command.
And so many people from military programs go into NASA.
Sure.
And
that's a fast track if you want to be an astronaut.
They take that stuff very seriously, you know, rank and all that. Afterward, I think the entire like flight crew and the team in Houston were awarded some medals of distinction. I can't remember the actual
Neat.
Name of them. But yeah, everybody there, I could see why he wouldn't want to necessarily take on a different rank than he was, you know, or a higher rank or anything like that.
Yeah. Plus, like, you know, like, there's only, there's less than 20 dudes that did what he did, period. Like, you know, he doesn't need to be a glory hound.
No.
I don't know. I don't, how much more do you have to say? Because, like, the closing thought, I thought this movie, and it's kind of depressing, because I remember when I watched this movie being somewhat inspired by Tom Hanks quoting some of the final passage in Jim Lovell's book, where he goes, "I look up in the moon and I wonder when will we be going back and who will it be?"
Yeah.
And I, you know, there's a lot of talk in the early days of the Bush administration about reviving a moon plan. And I was only against it in so much as I thought we should be going to Mars instead of like going back to the moon. But like, it literally is kind of wild to me that 25 years later, we haven't gotten beyond low Earth orbit.
Yeah.
You know, like, we got the space station and we got a permanent campsite for humanity outside of the Earth's, not even outside the Earth's atmosphere. And that's cool. That's cool and all. But I'm just kind of shocked that we've had this technology. We've had the technology to explore quite a bit of the solar system. And we have done, to be fair. We've sent, you know, and there's their argument that, like, you get more science for your buck by sending robots and probes. And I certainly have been thrilled with all the shit we've done with the Martian rovers and whatnot. But, like, damn, you really can't beat the wonder of actual explorers going and landing on alien worlds and taking pictures and leaving footprints and coming back to tell their tale, or staying there and starting a new branch of the human civilization. That's like, you know, and I don't know. There's a lot that could be said with to go with this. I'm trying to keep everything like super positive other than for fucking journalists.
Well, I guess, yeah, when I saw this movie, the first, I don't know, 10, 15 times, I was not nearly as jaded as I am now. And I didn't know as much about like the space race and all that stuff. There's a line in this movie where they say, you know, it wasn't a miracle. We just decided to go. And the reasons around deciding to go are shitty. Like, oh, we just want something to boast about over the Russians, essentially. You know, maybe economically we want to hurt them, something like that. But the sentiment is very much true. Like, we have a distinct lack of will right now for space exploration, and that is unfortunate. And that's one of the good things. Another one of the good things potentially that I see in privatizing this is that that will can be, you know, tied to something other than just will. Because really, when you're talking about the government sponsored stuff, it's really just about whether we want to go do this or not. And essentially, whether we, like, that determination is made by whether we want to rub it in another country's face that we can do it. Like,
right.
As it was in the 60s. So, like, I'm tentatively optimistic about our new forays into space and how, you know, exciting and how driven we'll be to do that stuff.
I do, because I remember I was really taken with Robert Zubrin's book about, I can't remember what it's called. I think it's
Case from Mars.
The Case from Mars. Thank you. Because he made it a point. It's like, you know, one of the things, because he wasn't considering private space flight. He was doing everything through NASA. And he's like, you know, one of the considerations you got to think on these missions is you have to be able to do something within two presidential terms.
Yeah.
Because, like, the way anything works is, like, you spend probably 90% of your budget in the final 10% of the phase. So anytime you've got, like, say a president, it's all about space, and he gets elected in the second, and early in his first term, he says, "Hey, we're going to go to Mars, and we're going to do it in 12 years or 15 years. He wins a second term election, he gets it 8 years. His opponent looks at this budget and says, "How much have we spent? And how much we got left to spend? And this isn't my project."
Yeah.
Fucking shit can it. And the private sector can, you know, corporations are immortal and boards of directors can last for as long as they're doing their job. Like, that is a strength of it. Mm-hmm. But I do hate that it's a political thing. Like, our will to explore is, you know, like, what you said about not being jaded is exactly how I feel. Because, like, at one point I thought John Kennedy was sincere about, hey, we're going to go to the moon and do all these other things, not because it's easy, but because it's hard.
Yeah.
No, it's because it's geopolitically advantageous to, like, you know, not allow the Russians to get a foothold in the moon, and then they might shoot rune rocks at us, and you know, if we can fucking land a man on the moon, where can't we land the moon? Where can't we land a multiple reentry rocket? You know, yeah. Nowhere, bitches. We own this rock. Like, it sucks. It sucks.
Yeah.
That we have to invent reasons to explore.
And it should be something that should excite all of humanity, right? It should bring people together. It should not be a dividing force. Like, the exploration of our universe is something mm-hmm. that, to me, is personally exciting. And brings me closer to everyone involved in the process. And that should be everyone, not just, you know, a handful of people in this government administration that's underfunded.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, it feels like the other thing that missing there is for the political will is you got to take care of people. Because as long as we have people in our country that are hungry, are improperly housed, don't have health care, like, it's going to be a losing argument to try to like spend ever more money to get two or three people onto some rock in space.
Yeah.
Like, if we can solve those problems, then like finding the will to like explore and lift our heads up instead of keeping our heads fixed down on the ground gets a hell of a lot easier. And I don't think it's any accident that, like, you know, we did all these things in a time where, like, well, I don't know. Let's just leave it that. Like I said, I don't want to turn this into, hey, you know what? Politics. Go to swizzbowl.com.
but this movie does excite
this
me.
In the
way that a space program is supposed to excite you. I still, even after seeing it so many times and not having seen it for a very long time, coming back to it, I'm still excited by the same points. Like, I'm still excited, like I said, with that MacGyver moment when they dump all the shit on the table. I'm still excited when, you know, they hit they try and do their burn, their course correction burn. I'm still super excited when they finally open those parachutes, right? Or they reestablish communication. Like, those are just heart pumping, just inherently exciting moments in this film, and they still work. This film holds up. It's one of my favorite films.
It is amazing. My heart is in my throat, though, this entire 3 minutes, and we're just gawking at, like, wives and sons and daughters and parents and friends worrying about the people they love, you know?
Yeah,
and
I feel that worry.
Yeah, and, like, the whole world can do that at one remove. And that's the thing, like, man, geez, remember a time when we were all, like, on the same page about something?
Yeah.
But I don't know, because, like, I don't want this stuff to be a distraction from real problems, I guess, is what I'm saying. But on the other hand, what a great distraction if you need it.
Sure.
Apollo 13. Just a great movie. And
if you're 24 years old, maybe check it out for the first time.
Yeah. Like, if it's like because it holds up, man.
Yeah.
It's funny because, like, Jim Love, I guess that's a decision Ron Howard made. He didn't want to. And I thought this was an interesting decision. He didn't want to use any of the actual archival film, which I just when me and Jack went to the exhibit and we saw the Apollo mission film. It was like the IMAX thing. This shit was shot on glorious, like, 70mm film, and I think stereo vision. Like, you could watch this in 3D if you wanted. Huh. Like, when I saw this on the IMAX, like, it actually makes the Apollo 13 stuff look, you know, not shitty, but, like, what I'm saying is, no, like, why the fuck when you have this glorious, maybe they hadn't restored it all yet. It's been 25 years since. And I think that's one of the big, you know, reasons that this movie got released, the Apollo, the film. But Jim Lovell said that, like, when he saw it, he swore that, like, he had to been using archival footage. Or, like, I've never seen this footage before. Which NASA archive did you get it out of? Like, the man who watched the rockets launch into space, was on the rockets launching into space, thought they were utterly convincing. And 25 years later, they are rock fucking solid.
Nice.
Because they actually did. They filmed in zero G. They rebuilt those things. They hired the same film, the same team that actually restored the real Apollo capsules for, like, museum display, to build their mock-ups of the capsules and things. And nice. That detail, that attention to detail, shows. And unlike, there's a couple of contemporary films, like, I think Jurassic Park, a little show in its age in places. You know, that CGI is just, like, CGI has gotten so good that, like, some of those shots are not as convincing as they originally were. Apollo 13 is just rock solid. Yeah. I got a 13-year-old that would call it out if it wasn't. He'd be like, when is this film made, Dad? Was this film made before I was born? Why is it so old? Why can I see the film grain?
Is this the first film in color?
So, great movie. Anything else you want to say?
No, that's it.
Well, next week, we are going to do a post-July 4th of July, the 4th of July Hangover podcast, which is going to be Born on the 4th of July. A movie starring Tom Cruise. It was directed by Jesus Christ, JFK guy.
Oliver Stone. Wow.
Thank you. Oliver Stone. Nominated for a bunch of Oscars. Amazing soundtrack by John Williams. We'll be back next week to enjoy that. But I hope everybody enjoys their 4th. If they're an American, if you're a rest of the world, you know, I don't know. So, keep us in your thoughts.
Yeah.
But we will be back next week. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.